Welcome to episode 31 of Mancy, a podcast about magic and the fucked up shit people did with it. In each set of episodes, we cover a different Mancy or method of magic. I'm RJ Walker. I'm a spoken word artist and writer. With me is my co-host, Elle.
I'm Elle Alder, a professional psychic and solitary eclectic witch.
Last week, we dove into the history of the tarot and its origins as a card game and gambling epidemic catalyst. All of this in the 1400s Italy. The gambling epidemic was so bad that the game was associated with foolishness, which is how tarot got its name. Eventually, the gambling epidemic got the attention of the church, and leaders declared the game to be sinful and the work of the devil, so the tarot players doubled down, because that's what gamblers do, and added the devil as a trump card in the game. This would be the first time the game would be associated with the occult. The game would continue for centuries until other card games and card decks would take its place as it fell from popularity to French dudes in the 1700s, Antoine Court and Etelier began assigning divinatory meanings to the cards. The tarot would be used by secret societies and shadowy spiritualists in Europe and America, where the meanings would change and the practice would be closed. Can't have the unwashed masses doing the special secret magic now, can we?
No.
Yes.
Special.
We also began the biography of Aleister Crowley, who is considered one of the most prolific occultists of all time. We went over his early childhood, school life, realizing his bisexuality, and his growing interest in the occult. We left off with Crowley leaving school just before graduation to become a full-time occultist, because who needs degrees when you have magic?
That's what I always said.
And now we're going to continue our coverage of Aleister Crowley and the tarot, one of the most popular methods of divination in the world. In pursuit of his occult interests, Crowley traveled all over the world to uncover magical secrets and network with like-minded occultists. While in Switzerland researching alchemy, he met a chemist named Julian L. Baker, who also had an interest in alchemy. Which, like, if you're a chemist in 1898, a lot of the shit you're doing
is
fucking alchemy.
Yeah.
It seems like magic. It feels like magic. Everybody's going to call it magic. It's magic.
Mm-hmm.
It was Baker's brother-in-law that led Crowley to the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, a secret occult society that was only like 10 years old by the time Crowley joined. And the Golden Dawn would go on to be one of the most influential secret societies in occultism. I'm going to do my best to go over what we know, but I mean, it's a secret society, so a lot of secrets.
Yeah, it's a lot of secrets.
And as far as the hermeticism part, we're going to talk a little bit more about that in alchemy when we talk about Hermes Trismegistus.
Okay.
That'll be later.
I actually don't know, I think, hardly anything about the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Just Hermetic. I have a Hermetic tarot deck that I don't like.
Hermeticism? It's actually, like, kind of fucking cool.
Okay.
Yeah. And, like, its relationship to the Kabbalah is also pretty cool. But,
okay.
The founders of the Golden Dawn were also Freemasons. So they were no strangers to being part of secret societies and practicing secret rituals. While the Freemasons themselves practiced rituals and had some occult leanings, the Golden Dawn was, like, all in on the occultism. And that was their main focus. They structured themselves after the Freemasons with a hierarchy of initiations. Of course, there was one big difference. The Golden Dawn allowed women. The Freemasons did not. And this was a bit of a big deal in the late 1800s. Since its inception, Freemasonry excluded women and, at worst, proclaimed them to be inferior to men. Then, in 1882, a woman named Marie d'Erasmus was initiated into a Freemasonry lodge. She was an author and an outspoken women's rights activist. For doing this, the Grand Lodge essentially disowned the lodge that initiated her. she resigned to allow the lodge to regain its status. She had learned enough and started her own sort of unofficial mixed gender Freemasonry. This would be the origins of the more progressive continental Freemasonry, and all female lodges began to pop up and would become more recognized over time. Most Anglo-American lodges still don't recognize women as legitimate Freemasons today. One more note, though. In 2018, the United Grand Lodge of England released guidance regarding transgender members. This made it clear to all lodges that transgender men were allowed to join male lodges as men.
Wow.
It also stated that if a trans woman joined a Freemason lodge before transitioning, their status as a Freemason is not nullified. The language specifically says a Freemason who, after initiation, ceases to be a man does not cease to be a Freemason.
Oh, okay.
So weirdly progressive for a not very progressive kind of group. At least in 2018.
I feel like, yeah, it's kind of interesting because, so for future episodes, I just started reading a book called Queer Magic. And it talks about how throughout history, magicians and people who practice magic are like viewed like as queerness is an essential part of that magic. So it doesn't really surprise me because I think while gender perspectives are very progressive, like in political societies, I don't think in magic societies. I mean, that's pretty much where queer people have gone forever. And so queer and gender nonconforming people, I feel like fit in really well with those. I guess it depends on how tightly knit they are with Christianity. So depending on the Freemasons, like association with Christianity, that's fucking weird.
But I mean, they're fairly secular and, you know, multi-religious. A lot of it is philosophy based.
Well, and I would say because that's the issue with queerness is Christianity, basically, like in other religions like that, you know. Anyway,
the Golden Dawn set itself apart by not being another sausage fest, no girls allowed boys club like the Freemasons and other secret societies of the time. It's progressiveness, I think, that made their work so influential even today. Their rituals were focused on theurgy, which is a magical practice designed to invoke deities or powerful spirits to enhance one's own spiritual power. The Masons did that too, but the Golden Dawn was more open to paganism and folk magic. Many present-day concepts of ritual magic come from the Golden Dawn. Some rituals in Wicca and neo-paganism are directly inspired by Golden Dawn rituals. So, like, here's the thing. Like, yes, Wicca is like a very, very old pagan religion, but a lot of that was just straight up lost. Through like acts of genocide and cultural genocide.
Is Wicca, this is a thing that I should know, how closely related is it to Druidism? Is it kind of, because it's very really, similar, right?
Really fucking close. Yeah. A lot of Wicca was practiced by the Picts who were wiped out by the Vikings. I'm playing through Assassin's Creed Valhalla right now, and it's, yeah, totally a thing.
We learn all of our historical everything from
Assassin's Creed, yeah.
games and movies. Okay, because, well, and I would say like if a lot of that got lost, like a Wiccanism got lost in all of, you know, the genocide, cultural genocide, then that would make a lot of sense.
And it was these secret societies that were all about like trying to revive this.
Yeah.
Even if they were like way off the mark, they were like, this is as close as we can get.
I would say this is just like a quick aside. I have a friend who is like very not okay with Wiccan anything because of the history of child sex practices that have taken place in Wicca. But I have a feeling that has to do with the revival of it in combination with Aleister Crowley.
Yeah, when you talk about people who are Wiccan today, it is very different than talking about like the ancient Picts or Druids.
No, yeah, she just is like, because she's read through a lot of, I mean, she's very, very well versed in Wiccanism and reading through some of the lost rituals and some of the books that people don't want to talk about in conjunction with Wiccanism have fucking gnarly and scary shit in them.
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
And it's like still stuff that you could find today. And it is very different, but like Wiccan is like Christianity light. So
yeah. And there's also like neo-paganism, which is what I think a lot of the people who are like solo spiritualists, you know, practice like a more like neo-paganism of like, this is going to be kind of my own thing rather than, you know, this is like what, what's her name in Australia?
Mm-hmm.
Practice the artist.
The Witch of King's Cross. I can't remember her name, but yeah, it's the Witch of King's Cross.
Rosalind Norton.
Yes.
Yeah.
Her name is so good.
So she was neo-pagan.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, a lot of the stuff in that were directly inspired by things the Order of the Golden Dawn created or tried to revive. The Golden Dawn is the single largest influence on occultism in the 20th century, I can confidently say.
Mm-hmm.
The Golden Dawn's first order was to learn the Hermetic Kabbalah and the philosophies therein regarding spiritual growth and divinity. It's all highly complex, and I don't have time to go over all of it right now. There's so much. But I will say that these philosophies are highly influential in pop culture. If you've played Final Fantasy or watched Neon Genesis Evangelion, you've encountered some of the philosophy in the Hermetic Kabbalah. The other thing that they would study involve the classical elements. See, you know, Pydromancy episode that we did, or the Hydromancy episode that we did for more info on the classical elements. And also alchemy, which we're going to do an episode on soon. Astrology, which we'll probably do an episode on eventually. Geomancy, and of course, the tarot. The same tarot divination that was defined by Antoine Court for use in Freemasonry was adopted by the Golden Dawn and changed by them. And this is where that Kabbalah stuff starts to really like get put into the tarot versus what Antoine Court wrote. Aleister Crowley worked his way up through the ranks of the Golden Dawn, and he would move to a luxury apartment in London where he would hire another Golden Dawn member, Alan Bennett, to be his personal magic tutor. Bennett's guidance would help accelerate Crowley's progression through the Golden Dawn's ranks. He was just fucking tearing through the ranks. Together, they would explore the ceremonial use of drugs to perform the rituals in the Goetia. And I'll probably talk more about the Goetia in an episode on demonology and summoning, for sure.
Okay.
I'm to be very brief and to summarize, it is an occult instruction manual on how to summon demons, or rather old gods that Christianity has demonized, and convince them to grant you official boons. I've actually done a lot of research into the Goetia when I was writing my play, A Sacrifice Summoning a Swan Song, which is an interactive play where you summon demons. The audience summons demons.
RJ called me in as a source on that one to help him write it.
If you've seen Hereditary, you've encountered the Goetia because the Goetia ritual is literally you see it and the image in Hereditary.
Oh, is that
the Paimon? Is one of the demons in the Goetia.
Do you remember when we went to my dad's like a week after we watched that? And it was like, my dad has this like wrought iron door outside of his house. And it's the symbol. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Creepy.
That was real spooky. Eventually, Bennett went to Asia to study Buddhism and other types of Asian spirituality. After that, Crowley moved to Scotland. Buying a famous manor near Loch Ness.
He does know you don't have to get the most expensive best thing every time you do something, right? Like, he's aware.
We'll go into this. Because this is like, do you need the most expensive best thing? No, you need the thing with the most magical power, which sometimes is the most expensive best thing.
Okay.
The house is called the Bolskine House. That's what it is. The Bolskine House. And it's...
Is it an Airbnb?
Quite a sight to behold. No. I bet Ghost Adventures is going to do something there eventually. But even before Crowley moved in, the manor had a reputation for being haunted. Legend had it that a group of evil wizards had performed necromancy at the nearby graveyard, and a minister had to return the risen corpses to their graves. And you might think it's weird that the manor on a lake has its own graveyard. Well, that's because it was built on the site of an old church, and old churches have graveyards. And that church that the manor was built on top of burned to the ground, killing the whole congregation inside.
Fuck.
Yeah. Nobody knows how it burned down, just that it did and it killed everybody.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Later, a rich dude bought the land and built the manor on top of the burned church because he wanted a hunting lodge and thought the site would piss off another rich guy who he was feuding with near the area. It's like, you don't like that I'm on top of this fucking church? You can go screw yourself.
I don't think that's what he said.
Yeah. The Bolskein house is said to be extremely fucking haunted, even before Crowley got there. And there's even a tunnel connecting the house to the graveyard underground.
Fuck,
an
were
old
they
holdover
like,
from the church.
I was like, they probably used it as body snatching at certain points, I'm sure.
Probably fucking Scotland at that time, yeah.
Yeah, that's how people made money, like, fuck.
Yeah. Crowley believed the location would be perfect for his rituals. Specifically, he wanted to perform the rituals in the sacred magic of Abramelin the Mage, who is basically like a supposed magician of ancient Egyptian origin. He's also called Abraham or Abraham of Worms. Abramelin the Mage had specific systems of magic, divination, and conjuration. One of my favorites is the use of magic word squares, which is a type of acrostic poetry where the words are arranged in a perfect square, spelling words in every direction. So,
yeah.
Heart, ember, I think is one I did. And yeah, and then you read it diagonally, you can read it horizontally, and you can read it vertically.
Mm-hmm.
And those would work as like sigils and wards. And I created one in an escape room I designed actually, which was really fun. They had like wooden blocks and they try to make an acrostic word square with the wooden toy blocks.
Have you ever, I feel like this is related but not related. Have you ever looked at the history of abracadabra, the word, and like how people would use it for sigils?
I create
to, like,
as I speak.
Do and yeah, but it's like the slow, anyway.
Yeah. The spell Crowley really wanted to perform, though, was a ritual designed to summon and manifest one's guardian angel. In his book, The Confessions of Aleister Crowley, he says, "The first essential is a house in a more or less secluded situation. There should be a door opening to the north from the room which you make your oratory. Outside this door, you construct a terrace covered with fine sand. This ends in a lodge where the spirits may congregate."
I had to take my headphones off.
Yeah, you don't like my Aleister Crowley voice.
I don't. It's creepy.
Aleister Crowley is creepy.
It makes me uncomfy.
Aleister Crowley makes me uncomfy.
Yeah, it's true.
The ritual is extremely difficult and extremely lengthy. It takes 6 months to complete it and requires complete celibacy and no consumption.
No, he didn't do that.
No consumption
he
of alcohol
did
at
not.
Any point. He was isolated in his fucking manor on the lakes.
So wait, does celibacy include masturbation? Because there's no
yes.
fucking way. No way.
Yes.
For 6 months?
6 months.
He was like, I gotta save up the juice.
Yeah.
I gotta save up the juice.
Gotta
like,
save it up.
And
no consumption of alcohol at any point in this process.
But not cocaine, which
not,
is fortunate.
Not cocaine. Fortunate for Aleister Crowley. It doesn't say anything about cocaine. It requires the magician to summon the 12 kings and dukes of hell and bind them, removing any influence they may have on the magician's life. Rumor has it that Crowley's ritual failed, and he unleashed demons on the house, resulting in extreme paranormal activity.
Amazing.
After the Second World War, Major Edward Grant purchased the house to retire there. He shot himself in the head with a shotgun in Aleister Crowley's former room. After that, a newlywed couple purchased it. The wife was blind, and after a month, the husband just walked away one day and disappeared. He abandoned her to walk aimlessly and heartbroken in the confusing, haunted house for an undescribed length of time. Then, Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin fame purchased it because he's an Aleister Crowley fanboy. Page wanted the house restored to how it was when Crowley owned it and left it in the care of a man named Malcolm Dent, who began to have violent paranormal experiences.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, so who owns it now?
We'll get there.
Okay.
So according to Dent, the house would rumble as if the hallways were growling. He also reported hearing beasts pacing outside of his doorway.
It's just Rocco.
But when he checked, nothing was there. Yeah, it's your dog. Astrally projecting to Aleister Crowley's fucking haunted house.
That's probably where he fucking came from.
Yeah. Paige would have some, like, Aleister Crowley fan art painted on the walls, but eventually the house changed hands again and again until it burned down in 2015, just like the church it took the place of. They rebuilt it, but
Why?
It burned down again.
Why?
It
Why?
Burned down again.
It doesn't want to be there.
It burned down again in 2018.
Let the dead be dead, please.
It's like the fucking Salt Palace. Like, it just keeps burning down.
Well, stop building it. Like,
stop building it.
Just
yes.
Let it go.
So it burned down again in 2018, and the damage was so extensive, it would take someone with substantial funds and a deep interest in the occult to rebuild it. A foundation was formed to preserve the history of the place. As of today, it is currently being restored for the purposes of being opened to the public as a historical site. They're fucking crowdfunding it. I know.
Imagine being spooky. Like, the demons live here, and the demons burn down the house twice, and they're like, you know what the demons want? A fucking museum. Why? Why would you do that? What, in the gift shop, it's just like a set of like the 12 demons as like stuffed puppets.
Beanie Babies. Yeah,
And you can like line them up in a circle, and then it has a pentagram in the middle of it when you do that.
You know, and you know for a fact Ghost Adventures is going here.
I wonder if they haven't been able to, because that's the thing that they have, that they have to receive
special. It's been like a private property, but as soon as it's open to the public and
it
turns into a museum, you best believe Ghost Adventures
they'll do
is
it
going
before.
There.
They'll be like, Zachary will be like, not
the day
yet,
before the opening.
Not ever seen by the public as this. We are here for lockdown.
Aleister Crowley, are you here?
Come on out of
the... my voice, Aleister Crowley.
What's the one that he yells right before he gets attacked?
Oh, my dick is burning. My dick is burning.
Look at it. There's three. It's gone.
Three scratches, and it's in syphilis.
Is it true, Aleister Crowley, that you had syphilis 5 times? How many times? Probably 20.
We'll get there. Right now, we're on two.
Two, yep.
We'll get there. And syphilis was deadly at the time, so shocking that he had it twice.
Yeah, they didn't have penicillin, did they? Or this might have been right when penicillin was
like
thing,
right, I mean, about then. But Aleister Crowley was like fucking hiking mountains and living on Loch Ness. Like, I don't know. But yeah, we'll get back to Aleister Crowley in a bit. But now it's time for the extra spell. And this extra spell, sponsored by me. Me. It's sponsored by me and my new book, The Ghost Was Always the Machine. It's a heavy book of poems that combines digital and analog poetry with interactive sort of text adventure style poems hidden within the book. So you can get that at rjwalkerpoet.com. And we're going to talk about, as we promised in part one, the exceptional artist who illustrated the iconic images of the tarot. Pamela Coleman Smith. So Pamela Smith was introduced to the Order of the Golden Dawn by the same poet that inspired Sylvia Plath to explore the occult, W.B. Yeats. Pamela Smith was quickly initiated and began the process of doing occult rituals in 1901 and met a dude named A.E. Waite, a Golden Dawn member who outranked her by a lot. And they became friends. And there was a schism in the Golden Dawn that Crowley was smack dab in the middle of. And
of course.
We'll get to that schism later in our story about Crowley, though. In any case, Pamela found herself on the same side of the schism as A.E. Waite. And the reconstruction of the Golden Dawn required some updated magic. So Waite commissioned Pamela, who was a professional artist, to update the images of the tarot following his book on how to interpret the cards. Mm-hmm. So he Pamela was mostly known for her eye-catching broadsides and, like, posters, like, to advertise things like the carnival in town or, like, a show or a play or something. Mm-hmm. And she would do these, like, really dope posters. And you can see that influence in the tarot cards. They look like really dope
posters. Yeah, they're very detailed and intricate and really thought out. And they have, like, it's, like, full of yellows and reds. Like, the yellow is very yellow. The red is very red.
The things that if you're walking down the street and you see it, it catches your eye and you want to look.
Yeah, I didn't know that she did poster art. That's cool.
Mm-hmm. So when Waite approached her with the tarot job, she was genuinely excited, even if the pay was pretty low. And we don't know how low, but we do know that she didn't get any royalties. That's for sure. While Waite had some suggestions based on astrological significance connected to some of the cards, he mostly let Pamela do her own thing, which I am, for one, grateful of, because the art of the tarot is amazing. Mm-hmm. Trusting that she knew the magic because she was also a member of Golden Dawn, especially with the pip cards. You can see Pamela really, really shining. Yeah. Like, there's all this meaning in the, like, major arcana that I'm sure, like, there were paragraphs about, like, what these represent. But the pip cards were just a little bit smaller, and you can see that there's a lot more action and movement and storytelling, I think, in the pip cards themselves.
Yeah, the pip cards are – so there are decks that actually, when you lay the cards out end to end – I can't remember the name of the deck off the top of my head. I have it somewhere at the house, so I'll have to show you. But if you lay the tarot cards one after another, they just tell the entire story. Like, it literally is one large story. And that's kind of the idea. When you read the tarot, of course, you can read the story of the major arcana, but each one of the suits has its own story as well that you're going through. And they are a lot more action oriented because they aren't talking about archetypes, or they aren't talking about these, like, huge things. They're talking about the mundane moments in everyday life in a lot of instances.
Yeah. I mean, like, you compare, like, Nightmare Swords, the Nine of Swords, of, like, a person, like, sitting up and their hands
having nightmares
from a nightmare. And then you look at something like
the devil,
or the sun, or the or the star, right? And it's a little more static, or the devil, where it's like that features a character, like an archetype, like the recognizable of the devil. But the pip card more tells a story in its own, whereas the devil and those cards are part of the larger story of the Fool's Journey.
Yeah, because the individual, like the smaller cards are talking, minor arcana cards, sorry, specifically, are talking about our relationship to different things that we're experiencing, or they're talking about specifics of the circumstances that we're in, which is why I like tarot, because it gets down to that specific. It can be both the devil, someone is controlling you, and it can be the Eight of Swords, which is feeling completely trapped and stuck by your own mental capacities. So it has, like, a really nice breadth to it that I feel like other forms of divination don't, because it has this system. And because Pamela Smith went into detail and depth, and there's 500 million, there's probably literal thousands of different types of tarot cards and different illustrations and stuff, but all of it is largely based in Pamela Smith's interpretation and
like
art.
Pamela got the job and then just made like fucking Phil Collins on the Tarzan soundtrack.
Yeah, she did. She went fucking hard.
Yeah. Also, Pamela had synesthesia, blending colors and sounds. Her experience traveling with a theater troupe also strongly influenced her art, because she would create the posters for the theater troupe and help with costuming. That's why, you know, all the characters have these bright, colorful, like very theatrical looking costumes.
She also based it on like kind more like I don't want to say ancient interpretations, but like medieval. And so there's things like in the cards, like in the Five of Wands, every single person on the card has a different outfit, when in the time all the colors and kinds of outfits would have been the same from the same region. So a lot of times when she was doing their artwork for them, she was looking at specific symbols that would have existed back then. So people sometimes have a hard time applying like modern day filters to the cards, because they're not only made in 1901 or whenever, but they're also based on medieval times with a lot of the depictions. So that's another reason people struggle with them, but that she did a really phenomenal job, because a lot of the stuff that she interpreted with Bible verses and the way that we look at things biblically in the Torah, you can translate it perfectly now.
And like, you look at what the tarot looked like before, and they looked like how, like, the face cards look on the typical playing cards we have, is they're very, like, sort of stained glass, staticky looking.
Yeah, they're not, characters. They're not, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Pamela knew how to draw a goddamn scene.
She did.
You know, like, she knew what storytelling was, and that really shows in her art. And while The Fool's Journey was a story from beginning to end, you know, the pip cards help tell their own stories. And I think you've got to be an incredible fucking artist to pull that shit off, especially with the just amount of artwork you have to produce to make, whether there's 70 something cards or something like that.
Yeah.
And they're all unique, and every single card is iconic.
Yeah, people really are like, I guess I haven't gotten in a long time. I haven't read an affair or anything in a long time. But people are always like, oh, there's doubles of the cards, right? I'm like, no, bitch, they're all different. Like,
yeah.
And they all mean, I mean, they can mean similar things, but it's like specific flavors of things that she really captured. Like the Ten of Swords, which is about betrayal, is different from the Three of Swords. It has a different flavor of sorrow. It's a different flavor of sadness. Like the Eight of Cups is a very different flavor than the Three of Swords. Even though they're both talking about heartache and loss, it's just different. Colored it very differently. Yeah, there's so much stuff.
I honestly don't think the tarot would be as prolific as it is today without the art of
Pamela there's Smith. No way.
And, you know, with her work, the Waite Smith tarot deck was born. Of course, the cards were a hit, and Waite took the drawings for the deck to his friend, William Ryder, who had just assimilated another company that published, like, occult books and stuff. This new company was called Ryder & Sons, and it was a sub-company of Yewbury Publishing, which itself is a sub-company of Penguin Random House.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like, this is the big three of publishing. The publisher called these the Rider-Waite Tarot Deck because Waite had the rights since he commissioned them, and Ryder since he published them. Pamela Smith, though, was left out of the name. Which is a bummer because Pamela made these. Fucking Waite had the cards and some ideas. Ryder had some money and some means. But Pamela made this shit happen.
Mm-hmm. She did.
Even with her work being earth-shakingly influential, Pamela Smith continued her starving artist lifestyle, getting only a small inheritance from an uncle who died in World War I. She was able to buy a small vacation home, but she soon found herself buried in mounting financial difficulties, and her art could not keep up. She eventually died impoverished, her paintings and belongings auctioned off to cover her debts. Knowing this, there's a growing sort of movement to help Pamela Smith regain posthumous credit for her work by calling the deck the Rider-Waite Smith deck or the Waite Smith deck.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's the story of Pamela, also nicknamed Patty, sometimes Smith. This extra spell was brought to you by me and my new book, The Ghost Was Always the Machine. If you're interested in exploring what the idea of a book even is and the blurry line between digital media and analog media, this might be the poetry book for you. It's semi-autobiographical, and there's lots and lots of really intense and heavy poems in there, and some of them are interactive, some of them are audio, some of them are video, and you have to unlock them yourself by journeying through the book and going down the rabbit hole. And you can get that at rjwalkerpoet.com. Crowley traveled all over the world. He learned folk magic in Mexico, yogi spiritualism in India, Shinto Buddhism in Japan. And on the way, he continued mountaineering, fucking prostitutes, and accumulating diseases. Three times for the third syphilis.
I wonder if Aleister Crowley is with us and is like, thank you for counting.
For counting my syphilis cases. He contracted a serious case of influenza, malaria, and snow blindness.
Oh my god.
In addition to the syphilis.
Wow.
He was, like I said, an absolute fucking unit.
How can you survive that? Malaria is fucking intense.
Yeah. Eventually, he recovered from these and headed to Paris to meet up with his future brother-in-law, a painter, Gerard Kelly. He would also insert himself in the Paris art scene as a poet, and he eventually met Gerard's sister, Rose Kelly, who was being forced into an arranged marriage. And Crowley was like, "Yo, wanna elope with me so you don't have to do that arranged marriage thing?" And so they entered into a marriage of convenience.
Okay.
Which, like, I guess that's kind of a solid.
Yeah.
Kind of doing...
I mean, that's a way to do it, yeah.
This, of course, infuriated Rose's family and sabotaged his relationship with his brother-in-law, since she was technically his sister-in-law.
Yeah.
But, like, fuck it. He's Aleister Crowley. Like, he would ever give a fuck.
Yeah.
You know, he's had syphilis 3 times now.
And gonorrhea at least once.
Yeah. He does, like, I'm Aleister Crowley. I do black magic, climb mountains, summon demons, and do magic orgies. Fuck you.
Yeah.
And he took Rose on a honeymoon to Egypt until the shit with her family calmed down. He's like, "Hey, why don't we just, like, I was planning on going to Egypt if you want to just come along, honeymoon.
You want to go rob some grains?"
Yeah. But just at least until they stop getting pissed off at us. And in Egypt, he taught her the ancient Egyptian magic he was practicing with the Order of the Golden Dawn. In Egypt, claiming to be a prince and princess, they rented an apartment attached to an ancient temple site.
I wonder, because that's where they built, like, Coptic Christians built apartments on top of temple sites, mm-hmm. to hide from the Romans.
Yep, they straight up rented one.
And so they must have just, yeah.
Like, "I'm Prince Aleister Crowley, and this is Princess Rose."
So did I ever tell you about when I went to Egypt and we had a fruit plate in the room?
No.
So we, so I have... you know, like, a dream that some sugar daddy is going to find me and just be really fascinated with me. I would take a sugar mommy, too.
That's what fucking Aleister Crowley did.
That's, yeah, I'm down. I'm down for that. Like, if you're that person that's, like, just totally taken with me and you have a bunch of money and you just want to, like, pay me to be pretty and study magic, like, slide my DMs. It's fine. Let's just talk about this. But anyway, I've had this joke that I'm like, I'm going to go to Egypt. I'm going to find this prince. I'm going to get married to him. It's fine. So when we went to Egypt, we went with this company that, like, planned everything, because it's very, very hard to tour in Egypt. And you really have to have, like, a tourist company take you. So we were staying at the Four Seasons in Cairo on the first night, and my brother and I were, like, sharing a room. We have the same last name, so they always think that we're married, and we're always like... can we please have separate beds? So they, like, had to move our rooms because they didn't want to give us a king bed because we weren't married. And, you know, things are just different in Muslim countries. So they, like, moved us into this room, and it was great. And we had this, like, gorgeous fruit plate. Like, it was just, it was beautiful. It had, like, the biggest grapes I've ever seen, and, like, peaches and apples. There were little, like, Turkish delight candies and stuff on it. And we're like, oh, cute. We got spoiled with this little fruit plate. And the fucking card on it was His Royal Highness. It was like, it was a prince. And we, like, looked him up, and he's a prince in Arabia. Anyway, so we had his, like, fruit plate, and we, like, asked my mom, I was like, "Did you guys get a fruit plate?" She was like, "No, I didn't get a fruit plate. What do you mean you got a fruit plate?" I was like, "Well, we got a fruit plate." And then we figured out it was not our fruit plate, that it was a fruit plate for this prince that was supposed to be staying in our room that we got moved to. That we were like, oh, he was very old. Because I was like, I got to look up his picture to figure out if this
who
is my sugar daddy.
Who consumed my fruit plate?
Yeah, mom was like, "Did you guys eat it?" And we're like, "No, I didn't eat the prince's fruit." Anyway, yeah.
How dare you waste my fruit plate? There's no winning. There's no winning.
There's no winning. Yeah, it was like wild. They had... the prayer mats, like the prayer carpets and stuff in the room, because obviously he's very, like, Muslim, very, very, like, religious man. And we were like, just two stupid Americans in Egypt. It's fine.
So in this temple site, like, they rented an apartment that was attached to. Aleister Crowley was like, "Hey, Rose, how about I show you what my little Crowley can do and do a spell for you?"
Ew.
Hey, babe, this spell summons the ancient Egyptian god Horus. And then during this like spell he was doing in this temple, Rose's head was thrown back and her eyes rolled back in her head, and she claimed to have a vision from Horus.
You can't see my face, but it's pretty horrified. Okay, yeah. Tell me more.
And Crowley thought she was fucking with him.
You know what I would do if, like, fucking Crowley, like, rolls up and he's like, hey, I got a lot of money, want to go to Egypt while your family calms down? I'd be like, yeah, and I would play into every fucking, like, stupid-ass power trip fantasy he had, for sure.
Yeah. See, he never received visions from Horus or any gods or anything.
No, of course not. He got syphilis. What more do you want?
Yeah. Like, he did this whole, like, ritual that didn't work at this Loch Ness, like, haunted house.
Yeah.
And didn't get this shit. And she was just a plebeian. She didn't know any of this magic shit or who Horus even was. So he was like, okay, I'm gonna test her. I'm gonna just test her out. So he took her to an Egyptology exhibit where the Egyptian gods were depicted on stone tablets. And he asked her which god she saw. And she was able to accurately identify Horus. Without any prior knowledge to Egyptian mythology.
That doesn't work because she's a woman. Women don't.
Yeah.
It's not a thing.
What's also spooky, though, is that the exhibit number that had Horus on it was exhibit number 666.
What?
And Crowley was like, okay, well, fuck. Guess it's real. Synchronicities. What did he say? What did Horus say? Come on, tell me. What did Horus say?
What did Horus say?
And Rose replied, he said, they are waiting for you. And Crowley was like, dope, let's do more magic.
What temple did they live up by?
I have no idea.
Could you not find it?
I couldn't find it. This was just kind of like a story anecdote about Aleister Crowley.
Okay.
It was in some of the documentaries that we watched, but it didn't say the specific temple.
Okay.
And so they keep doing magic and some drugs. And Crowley began falling in love for realsy real with Rose rather than just the marriage of convenience. Eventually, Crowley got what he had wanted so badly in his Loch Ness manor. His guardian angel spoke to him. He said his angel's name was Aulis, and he brought messages from Horus. Crowley recorded these messages for 3 straight days. And they would become the book of the law, Crowley's magic philosophy. The philosophy goes thusly. Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law, meaning that adherence to Thelema, what he named his philosophy / religion, should seek out and follow their own true path and determine their own true will. Basically, you are the master of your own will. You control your own self and urges. Love is the law, love under will, i.e. the nature of the law of Thelema is love. But love itself is subsidiary to finding and manifesting one's authentic purpose or mission. Every man and every woman is a star. Which is to say that the 20th century era vulgaris cosmology, it is implied by metaphor that persons doing their wills are like stars in the universe, occupying a time and position in space, yet distinctly individual and having an independent nature, largely without undue conflict with other stars. So, like, your will should not conflict with other wills, or you should go away if that's happening. You should distance yourselves from each other if that's happening.
Did you know that ancient Egyptians believed that the subjects became stars?
Oh.
After, that's why they wanted to take care of, and that, so when they did the pharaohs, like, burying, and when they were decorating the temples or the burials things, they put all the stars on the walls because it represented one star for every subject underneath them, which is why they wanted to take care of them and make sure the body went to the next lifetime because they would be resurrected because they were stars. So just an interesting, like, parallel. Yeah.
Yeah. Crowley believed this would bring about a new spiritual evolution in mankind called the Aeon of Horus, which sounds like some fucking anime shit. It's like, I summon the Aeon of Horus. This magical armor allows me to... Of course, this kind of rogue magic behavior, especially the weird shit he did in Loch Ness, made other Golden Dawn members a little uneasy. They were like, what the fuck are you doing, bro? Like, we need to talk about this. They began to doubt the Golden Dawn's founder, Samuel Liddell Mathers. They didn't like some of the decisions he was making, and they also didn't like how buddy-buddy he was with Aleister Crowley. Or at least he looked like he was super close buddy-buddies with Crowley. Mm. And Crowley, to them, was just like this magical loose cannon who was like, summon him behind the demons, Horus is speaking to me. And they were like, whoa, bro, like, we didn't talk about any of this.
Yeah.
Mathers kept promoting Crowley through the ranks like crazy. He was still ripping through the ranks. And eventually, the London officials of the Golden Dawn refused to initiate Crowley to the next grade. Mathers overrode this decision and initiated him at the Paris Temple, but that wasn't winning Mathers any friends. Crowley demanded the London Temple recognize his rank and demanded the secretary of the order provide him with the papers. She refused, and in fact, this was the last straw for the London adepts of the Order of the Golden Dawn. And
you're
they demanded
out.
Mathers resign.
Yeah.
The other founders of the order were split on this, and it was clear that each was trying to push the other out. There were like three main founding leaders, and at this point they were like devouring each other. The temples revolted against each other, and the Order of the Golden Dawn broke apart in a schism. Crowley fucked off to Asia. With his wife, to avoid being caught in the fallout. He believed Mathers blamed him for the collapse of the Golden Dawn, and that he and other Golden Dawn members were performing magic spells against him to, like, curse him.
You know, so there's a thing that happens, right, where people are like, ugh, I've done all this stuff and everything was going so well and now I have to be cursed because everything is ruined. And like, maybe you're just fucking cursed. Like, maybe you're just a bad person who's done bad things. Maybe you're the person who's a narcissist who thinks that you don't have to earn the right to do all this shit. Maybe you don't fucking respect what anyone else does. Maybe no one's cursed you but yourself, Aleister Crowley. Also, if you're one of these people that's like, I do all these bad things, I don't know why I'm getting cursed. Like, it's you. You're your own problem. You need to fucking resolve that with yourself first.
And also, for comic book fans, Neil Gaiman adopted a lot of the actual history of the Order of the Golden Dawn breaking apart, because they were just fucking, like, slinging curses at each other and shit.
Yeah.
He adopted that into The Sandman.
There is, there's a series that's called The Magicians that's really good that we were talking about, like, last night, 2 nights ago.
Yeah, because Shadow and Bone is coming out, and I'm like, it's kind of like The Magicians.
So, in the books of The Magicians, in the first book, because it's a book series, they, like, graduate from this magical university that's like Hogwarts, but for adults. And
of course, gotta have a magical university.
You do. And because the idea is that these people go to get their graduate degree instead of going to regular college. It's like that time. So, they go to the school. Graduation night, they are given a demon that gets embedded into their back. You get, like, the professor, the headmaster, gets them really, really drunk because they need to be, like, numbed in order to get the fucking demon put in their back. And, like, there's this really good scene, I guess, where he's, like, talking, and he's talking about being magic, and he's like, you know, I think somehow the gods fucked up when they let us have magic, because how can you ever be an adult? How can you ever grow up if you know that you can have anything you want? And that is something that is really fucking true about magicians and witches and psychics.
And to further tangent this, that's actually a thought experiment that Plato wrote in the Republic about the Ring of Gyges. Sheep farmer finds a ring that can make him invisible. Therefore, he can do whatever he wants. So even though he was a good man before he found the ring,
you're not anymore.
He's not anymore because he can have whatever he wants.
Yeah. And I think that's true, that, like, people who get so fucking caught up in their own bullshit that just think that they know everything and think that they're all powerful and they can summon demons and they can talk to their fucking guardian angels. It's like, I think a lot of the work that I do is to demystify this and make it more accessible, because I think in doing that, one, it helps people get closer to themselves and feel like they have more control. And two, it takes power away from those fucking people. The people that gatekeep, the people that charge $500 to learn how to fucking read tarot cards, like all that bullshit. I'm like slowly dismantling that, because the only thing it leads to is bullshit like the Golden Dawn and Aleister Crowley and all of this shit that like nobody needs, nobody asked for, and is in a fucking appropriate.
So, to continue.
Should I ring the bell?
Two pop culture references and an ancient philosophy reference. We need to ring the bell.
It's time.
So, Rose, while they were in Asia in their fuck off phase, whatever the fuck off.
I want one of those. Whatever, I think we're there.
Whatever the fuck off version of a honeymoon is. Rose gave birth to Crowley's first child, who they named Lilith, because of fucking course.
Edgy.
Edgy. As his wife recuperated from the pregnancy, he entertained her by writing erotic poetry for her. He wrote so much, in fact, that he decided to start his own vanity press called the Society for the Propagation of Religious Truth, as a way to make fun of a Christian publisher called the Society for Promoting Christian Knowledge. So vain was his vanity press that he offered $100 to whoever could write the best essay on his work. Then it was time for mountaineering. Crowley decided to lead an expedition into the Himalayas in Nepal. Apparently, everyone hated him as the leader of the expedition, though. They mutinied against him and decided to climb back down the mountain at night. They were like, Crowley, you're going to get us all fucking killed, and we can't fucking stand you. Fuck off. We're going home. And Crowley was like, it is the middle of the night. Do not climb down this mountain. You will die if you do
and
that.
And they were like, we'd rather die than
like,
have you
we would
us.
Rather risk this mountain in the middle of the fucking night than spend one more second with your greasy ass.
I've known people like that.
Yeah. So, as a result, several of them did die.
Oh, no.
Doing this.
It's not funny.
The survivors blamed Crowley, and he was shunned from the mountaineering community.
Good. What would make you be so awful that people are like, this incredibly dangerous mountain, just fuck it, go back down?
Crowley met back up with his wife and daughter in India, and then some guys tried to mug him. So he shot him. Non-fatally. But he was still like, I gotta get the fuck out of town.
Yeah.
So they went to China, where Crowley discovered the perfect thing to pair with his daily guardian angel summoning chant. Like cheese and wine, he found opium and magic went together just swimmingly.
That does sound like it would be a good time.
His wife, Rose, found that alcoholism paired well with being married to Aleister Crowley.
I would absolutely agree with that.
Crowley parted ways with his family and went to Shanghai to try to summon Alwis again with an old like colleague of his from Golden Dawn times. Rose and Lilith were supposed to return to Europe. Crowley continued traveling to Japan, then Canada, and New York, where he tried to see if anyone would be down to hike the Himalayas again with him. And everyone told Crowley to shove it up his ass.
Yeah, like the last one, people hated you so much they died to be away from you.
Yeah, and he returned to Britain to meet up with Rose, who informed him that Lilith had died of typhus in Myanmar on their way back to Europe. Crowley would later blame Rose's increasing alcoholism for this.
Probably just dirty water.
Probably it's a really cramped fucking city that you're not familiar with and you don't have immunity to the viruses.
And yeah, and
you have
no idea. And that's what happens. And people died of disease all the fucking time.
Yeah. Crowley did not cope well with this loss.
Really?
Yeah, he did not. He began having flings with actresses and prostitutes and doing more opium.
Let me go ahead and just get the stick ready for the next occurrence of syphilis.
Rose gave birth to their second daughter. Crowley was determined to get his shit back together, though. And by back together, I mean he arranged the mess that he was already used to.
Okay.
He was like, this is getting too messy. And then he like kicks over a garbage can. He's like, there, that's much better. And the, that mess was, of course, getting back into magic. While he was having these flings, he did get, yeah, he got syphilis again. So let's.
Four?
Yeah, this is the fourth time. Four syphilises for Crowley and all is well. Later, Rose gave birth to their second daughter, Lola Zaza.
Zozo. That's well, Zozo. Close enough. Different. Yeah.
Lola Zaza was the name of their.
That's a cute name for a girl. Daughter. Yeah.
And with the Golden Dawn broken
their
into
new
pieces,
daughter.
Their new daughter. Yeah. The daughter version 1.2.
As though they like picked her up from the store. They're like, Lola Zaza.
I mean, they were so fucking whacked out. It probably felt like that.
They probably shouldn't have been parents. No, either of them.
No, definitely not. With the Golden Dawn broken into pieces, and Crowley decided to start his own thing based on the Book of the Law. His new occult society and beliefs were called Thelema, and the Book of the Law would be its Bible. With some of the old Golden Dawn pals he had, they formed their own secret society called A semicolon comma A.
Okay.
I would say AA, but...
But, yeah.
A, A. I think that's more what it is. A? A.
Okay.
He advertised in a periodical and new members started to join. And he was like incorporating Thelema into A with his old like Golden Dawn schism buddies. And like newspaper ads, join my creepy society and stuff.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Rose's alcoholism was reaching critical fucking mass. Crowley divorced her on the grounds of his own adultery. He was like, you know what? I keep fucking around. I should just divorce you. That just makes the most sense for both of us. And the judge was probably like, yeah, dude, why'd you let it get this bad?
Yeah.
And, you know, amicable divorces were not available at the time. So you had to have a reason. And one of the best reasons was adultery. And Crowley was like, oh, I know who's done that. They stayed friends, though.
Okay.
And Lola was trusted to Rose's care. But Rose would eventually be institutionalized in 1911 for her alcoholism. Wow. Crowley had other problems, though. The most pressing was that his inheritance was running dry. He needed new order members to start paying dues. So he did the opposite of what a secret society normally does. He made the rituals public and published the secrets in a book and in Vanity Fair. I shit you not, in Vanity Fair.
Wow.
Yeah. At least the lower level rituals were like public. The butt sex magic would be more advanced for more advanced initiates. However...
Did RJ just say butt sex?
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding. Butt sex magic.
Okay.
That was for the more advanced members of AA. However, the tarot was now back into the public. It was considered a lower, more accessible ritual. So he took it out of the fucking shadows and started giving it to all these people. And just doing tarot readings live, teaching people how to do it, teaching people the secrets, publishing the secrets to in like not even just books, like magazines that like lay people would just like pick up out of trash cans and stuff.
Wow.
And this pissed off Samuel Mathers so much. So much. Who was running his own broken faction of the Order of the Golden Dawn. And he decided to sue Aleister Crowley for releasing these secrets. The lawsuits were highly sensational, with Crowley being smeared as a devil-worshipping homosexual. And Crowley just leaned into it and says, yeah. Fuck yeah, I am. Totally. And that served to make his new organization seem edgy and cool.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. The downside was that the lawsuits were expensive, so Crowley expanded the rituals and included drugs in them. In fact, he was the first person to bring ritual drug use of hallucinogens into Europe, specifically peyote. In one AA gathering, he had everyone dress as deities and spike the punch with peyote. He received a fairly positive response from the attendees. Only problem with that was that the drugs were expensive, especially heroin, which Crowley was now heavily addicted to. So, more money in, more money out. More money, more problems. And his inheritance was still drying up. That meant it was time for a new book. A follow-up to the Book of the Law. And he called it the Book of Lies.
Okay. This is crazy.
It just gets crazier.
Okay.
The book was heralded as Crowley's capstone work and contained new rituals and new philosophies and new deities that all reinforced his work in the Book of the Law, until a German occultist named Theodor Rus accused Crowley of outright ripping off the work he was doing with his own secret society, which he called Ordo Templi Orientis, or OTO for short. Crowley said, "I don't know you, but that's my purse. I don't know you, never heard of you, but if we came to the same conclusions, man, we're probably both badass wizards and we should be friends." Like,
I thought you said losers instead of wizards, and I was like, yeah, probably. Yeah.
And you know what? Roos was like, "You make a good point. You did some crazy magic to find this. I did some crazy magic to find this. The fact that we came to the same conclusion just validates us both.
Yeah.
So let's work together." And Crowley established more OTO temples for Rus and began incorporating Thelemic tenets into OTO, pushing out some of the more Freemasonry parts of OTO. Finally, Crowley's inheritance ran totally dry, and he was relying exclusively on donations to OTO and AA sects. He moved to America to open up more OTO sects and spread his occult message. America was a hotbed for spiritualism in the early 1900s. He fell in with some Germans who were just so excited to work with him on their pro-German propaganda paper in New York.
No, of course.
The guy that hired Crowley was a spy for the German government, meant to spread misinformation to get American support behind the Germans in World War I. Turned out, Crowley sabotaged that propaganda effort and was reporting their moves to the British government. Because Crowley was a double agent. Sent to America to... I'm not fucking making this up. This has really happened.
Amazing.
Crowley was a double agent sent to America to spy on the Germans for the British government. Apparently, the British government recruited him because he had just this way of infiltrating and destroying secret societies.
We just needed him like 20 years later, really.
I know. Can you imagine Aleister Crowley destroying QAnon?
I was thinking more about like Aleister Crowley becoming like Hitler's second like right-hand man and just slowly.
Just like being so toxic, he destroys Nazis.
Well, and like Hitler would be really fucking into it, right? Because he was really into like the occult and mysticism and shit. I don't know. Maybe that would have gone really bad.
By then, tarot divination had begun spreading through America as British refugees brought it over during the war, and Crowley's OTO temples were doing their thing in America too, you know, having their like shows and publications and stuff. He also got phlebitis from needle usage and some, he needed some recovery time.
What is that?
For that phlebitis? It's like an infection in your vein or like inflated vein. Inflamed veins, and you get it a lot when you use needles a lot, or if you have an IV in too long.
Between his toes, he probably was out of veins.
He got it in his veiny veins. Usually, when you get phlebitis, that's when they start going for the toes.
Yeah, okay.
Because you can't use
like
that vein anymore.
Got it.
Yeah, and then it scars over and is all fucked up and infected and shit. Crowley eventually released his own tarot deck because he needed more heroin money. Called the Toth Tarot Deck.
So literally everything. Yeah. I feel like when people are like, "What's your opinion about Aleister Crowley?" And I'm like, "I don't really have one." I feel like that's fair because I'm not really sure that he did any of this thinking that he was trying to help anyone.
Yeah.
Versus like, "I need drug money. This is an easy way." Like, do you know how you make a lot of money? You give people secrets.
Yeah.
People pay for secrets.
This is exactly how it went. So like, is Aleister Crowley a bad dude? Kind of, sort of, yeah.
Yeah, there's not really, is he a good guy?
He's not really a good guy or a bad guy.
Yeah, he's just kind of a guy.
Yeah, he's just kind of a guy.
He's just a narcissist.
He's gross. He's just gross. So, of course, Crowley's heroin addiction was not getting any better. And after World War I, he didn't have his supplementary British spy income to rely on. Plus, Americans didn't know that he was a double agent, and so people kind of thought he was a traitorous piece of shit.
Yeah.
So it was time to, like, get the fuck out of America and get for real about being a cult leader. He bought a small villa in Italy and opened what he called the Abbey of Thelema. Just like any good cult leader, he formed a commune. They lived, like, lives in basically anarchy there. Crowley would paint horrifying pictures on the wall, and his followers would take hallucinogens, and he would have them stare at the horrible paintings until fear left their souls. The sex rituals involved huge orgies, and they did them out in the open with the children just totally unsupervised, watching the sex rituals happen, getting traumatized, not knowing what's happening, just in the middle of the villa. Some members complained that they didn't want to do the homosexual rituals or the butt sex magic. But Crowley told them, tough tits, this is what the magic requires. Crowley's nasal cavity also became eroded because he was doing so much cocaine and heroin, just dominated his life like never before.
He is Jim Jones. Because that was Jim Jones's, yeah. Like, like, rapid downfall was the drug use.
That's what's happening to Crowley right now.
Typically, that's where cults really go bad, is when the drug use starts happening. And
this is exactly where it starts to really go bad. Like, you thought the haunted house shit was bad. He didn't technically hurt anybody with that.
Yeah, he just was like, summoned some demons. Oop, didn't put him back.
Yeah,
like,
this is bad. They never ever once cleaned the Abbey of Thelema. Wild animals and rats infested the place. It became so severely unsanitary that one of the kids fucking died. Still, more followers came to the Abbey. Crowley started to realize something had to be done about his addiction, so he left for Paris for a cleanse. That failed. He just ended up doing more heroin.
Mm-hmm.
Crowley returned to the Abbey, still addicted. A young couple had just moved to the Abbey. The husband was very devoted to Crowley, and the wife hated her life at the Abbey. She gave testimony that her husband was made to drink the blood of a sacrificed cat, and that they had to cut themselves with a razor every time they referred to themselves with the pronoun I. Her husband drank from the polluted stream and developed a horrific liver infection and died. The widow returned to London and reported all of the fucked up shit at the Abbey of Thelema to the press. The same papers that called Crowley a traitor for not realizing he was a double agent now were calling him the wickedest man in the world and a man they'd like to hang.
Wow.
All this bad press and the total horror show that was the Abbey of Thelema ruined Crowley's standings in his own organizations. Successors were named, and Crowley, broke as a joke, all out of coke, moved into a slummy boarding house where he lived from fix to fix, growing more penniless from his books that wouldn't sell. And that's where everybody thinks the story ends, with Aleister Crowley dying of an overdose, broken alone in a boarding house. But no.
Mm-mm.
A woman arrived at the boarding house confessing to be a fan of Crowley's work and asking him if she could bear his child. Elle's stunned face.
How many occurrences of syphilis do you have to have before you can no longer fucking bear children?
It depends on how bad the syphilis gets and where it infects. But you can straight up die from syphilis.
I know. You go crazy. Syphilis is the one that you just slowly lose your mind. The infection, like, takes over your brain.
Dude, this, lots of things took over this guy's brain. Syphilis being one of them.
I think my thing with people like that is, like, what? Why? why do you just choose to continue to live? Probably how many moments, you know, were there where he was like, well, I could die right now. Nope, not gonna. Not gonna. Just gonna gotta keep suffering.
Yeah.
To do nothing,
and,
right?
And fucking... remember we watched some of these Crowley documentaries. You remember the YouTube video of the guy who was exploring the Abbey of Thelema and how fucking creepy it was?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, what?
Yeah, it's still fucking there.
Yeah, it is. And it's spoopy. Yeah, we were like trying to find an Aleister Crowley documentary, and then we just ended up on a rabbit hole.
Yeah,
a rabbit
hole on YouTube. A YouTube hole. Yeah. And it was just like this guy's like, hey, this is Aleister Crowley's house. Check it out. I'm going in. Oh my God, this is scary.
Yeah.
He's like, nah, I don't want to go back in there. There's needles on the ground and shit.
Yeah, probably from when he was there.
It probably looks right now like how Aleister Crowley looked in this fucking boarding house.
Yeah, poor guy. God.
And you know what? When this woman arrived and said, will you please bear my children like fucking Moroku from Inuyasha? He was like, fuck it. I got nothing else. And he did it. And this woman, Maria Sanchez, helped him get clean of heroin. Helped him through the withdrawals, helped him reconnect with the occult community, and helped him get several biographies on him published. Crowley died of chronic bronchitis at the age of 75.
What?
Yeah. He died a happy man with a loving wife and several children. All of that bullshit with the Egyptian gods and demon summoning and guardian angels and sex magic and drugs and spycraft, all of it. All that fucking bullshit in his life. And all he really fucking needed was just to calm the fuck down, live a life in reality with people who love him. And so ends our biography of Aleister Crowley. The just greasiest motherfucker and one of the most influential occultists of all time. Isn't that guy an absolute fucking unit?
Yeah, and I think... I don't know. There's a lot of elements in that of, like, I guess a lot of answers to questions that I have, like, on a philosophical level about magic and people who think they can just affect and control reality 100%. And I feel like I enjoy, like, being a human. Like, I think that I purposefully incarnated into this lifetime as a human so I could enjoy a lot of the human things. And it just is, like, you'll hear me talk a lot about how frustrating it is to have these people who are incredibly talented that, like, want to learn all this stuff that are really intelligent. You have to be incredibly fucking intelligent to understand the amount of stuff that he did. Like, just the sheer amount of, like, theory and knowledge and all of that.
Incredibly fucking intelligent and also incredibly fucking resilient to understand all that stuff,
like,
with a syphilis drug addled brain.
Yeah, like, to be the person. And it's, like, so frustrating because imagine what good he could have done for the world if it hadn't been obsessively, like, let's do all the opium and summon all the demons. Like, what could he have done for people if it wasn't that? And look at what he did on accident, right? That he gave us all those tools. And so it's kind of interesting because I think it asks me some very interesting philosophical questions about how I choose to live my life as a psychic. And, like, I try to be more grounded. I enjoy having human experiences and having a normal life and having a dog and having a family and having, you know, like, the stuff that humans have. And I also enjoy being a psychic. And I think a lot of times perhaps I feel not as valid in how I am a psychic because of the ways that I choose to have a very ordinary life in as many ways as I possibly can. But then if you think about people like fucking Aleister Crowley, who is incredibly talented and intelligent and had a lot of power and kind of wasted it all because he was just chasing this dragon of demons and guardian angels and shit. And it's like, could have just been in love and had kids.
That's how I feel about Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah.
Like, bro, you can just live a normal life and be a writer. You don't have to, like, this whole, like, write drunk, edit sober, let the thing that loves
Hunter
you kills
S. Thompson.
You. Like, fucking, like, tortured writer bullshit is fucking bullshit. Like, write the things that give you life, that give you excitement.
Yeah, and, like, experience things and, like...
In normal ways. You don't have to, like, fucking punch a shark.
Don't have to, like, I just think it's... You know, Aleister Crowley had more money than probably vast majority of people will ever get to experience. And like in a way, in a quantity that probably doesn't make sense now, but then did. And yet wasted it thinking he could buy spirituality, thinking he could buy what he was searching for, right? Like, mm-hmm. you need to buy the thing that has the most magic.
If I just go over all over the world, if I just learn more secrets, if I just, you know, get to the top of this mountain and see the thing nobody has ever seen,
then
I will be fulfilled.
Well, and I think, isn't that the nature of what you're exploring? Is like, I think some things are meant to be secrets and things are meant to be unfound. And I think we're supposed to, like, a huge amount of joy in life is like uncovering things slowly and the curiosity of being human and the experiences you get to have with that. And it's like, think about all the time and resources and everything you're wasting trying to find the secrets, trying to find the thing that feels like it's on the other side of the fence.
Are we saying that Aleister Crowley is like a completionist in an RPG?
Well, I'm just saying that I think I know people who listen to this show that feel similarly to how Aleister Crowley did, that need to think about that, like, in terms of a lesson of, like, what are you really focusing on building in your life? And how, if you have all the secrets, then what?
Yeah.
Then what do you have to live for? A woman who wants to help you be clean and sober and have kids with you and spend her life with you. Like, that's the secret, right? That's the happiness that you're looking for, is, like, sharing your life with someone or sharing good things or having people you enjoy being around. So maybe that's a good thing to think about in philosophy in terms of how we interact with and use magic.
I know. If Aleister Crowley would have paid a little bit of fucking attention to those Buddhism lessons that
you would know that if he just took like 2 fucking minutes to understand everything that he was compiling and think about it in some sort of analytical way, could have ended up somewhere very different. Well, I mean, he ended up pretty okay, I would say.
I guess, yeah, after much suffering.
But that's the thing, right? Is like, how much suffering are you willing to go through to get to the good shit? When you find out that the ordinary shit is the good shit, and it is possible to have those things without needing to suffer endlessly for them. And suffering doesn't make you more holy. It doesn't earn you more magical powers. It earns you fucking suffering. Don't choose suffering.
Unless you're a Puritan.
Well, your Jesus isn't real, but like, you know what I mean? Like that whole, like the bullshit of like suffering making you godlike, the suffering making you Christlike, the suffering means that you've earned fucking anything. Like, fuck that. Enjoy your life. Enjoy the life that you have. Be happy. Like, learn about magic because magic is fucking cool to learn about, not because you're going to uncover and unlock the secrets. Like, Aleister Crowley didn't do it. If he couldn't do it, you can't do it. Promise. You know, he had so much money and so many resources. And you know what he ended up with? A wife and kids.
Yeah.
That's crazy to think about.
Yeah. And what a weird ending for Aleister Crowley. Like, you think that there's like this poetic button of like the tragic hero gets what's coming to them as the consequences of their actions. And that did happen for Crowley. But then there is this little bow of hope at the top, you know?
Well, and I think that's true because, I mean, I think addicts just have really, really difficult lives. It's very hard and very lonely to be an addict. And the lesson there is like sobriety, you know, how much opium did he do until he was happy?
Yeah.
How much opium did it take? How much cocaine did it take? How many hallucinogens did he have to do until he was happy? Did he find it there? No, he found it in sobriety. So that's something to think about too.
Well, you know what brings me happiness? Pokemon.
Pokemons.
Yeah. So last time we did Cardomancy, Elle did a reading.
Did you open this?
Yeah, I opened it and shuffled the cards. I needed RJ, the new card like, smell. I'm sorry. I needed
is
it.
Is absolutely unable to do anything not fucking chaotically. So this box is like fucking ripped apart. Literally.
I couldn't figure out how to open it.
You could just ask for an adult if you don't know what the fuck you're doing, RJ. I needed
the child energy. It actually comes in a separate box.
I know. I can see that.
Than the decorative one. But
here, that's your card. The bird keeper.
Nice.
That's what I got for you.
So Elle did a reading with Yu-Gi-Oh cards in our pilot episode with Cardomancy. So now we're doing Pokemon. And this is a starter deck of Galarian Sirfetch'd. And there's a holographic Galarian Sirfetch'd in there. It's the only holographic card. Oh, that Pokemon card. That
yeah.
Shuffle sound. Oh, yeah.
Do people shuffle their Pokemon cards?
Oh, yeah. You have to shuffle your cards.
Hmm.
when you play. They're a little stiff, aren't they?
They're very stiff.
Yeah. A lot of people collect them, so they need to be sturdy.
Yeah. They're very stiff. Okay, so this reading is going to be for our Patreon subscriber, NN. I guess we're just going to have some cards pop out real quick. Okay, so this reading is for our Patreon subscriber, Enon, and his question is, what line of work can I go into that will be the most fulfilling? And if that's too big of a question, which of my strengths should I focus on right now? Both really okay. Great questions. Really, really good.
Yeah. Let's see what the Pokemon cards have to say about that.
Yeah. Oh, these spread so nice.
They do.
Ugh.
Because they've got this, like, glossy finish.
Yeah, there's, like, readers, you can tell when you get like a new deck and you go and it just like perfectly fans out, except the table is not grippy enough to grab the cards, so it doesn't give an even spread. Weird things that you learn. So when I was shuffling, three cards fell out. They fell off. And so we have the Hippodon. You're probably gonna have to help me with
Hippodon. Very strong, super tanky Pokemon. Ground types like a hippopotamus and sand.
If y'all could see my face when RJ corrected me. Hippowdon. Okay. Hippowdon. And then Trainer Hop.
Hop.
Yep. And then the holographic Galarian Sirfetch'd.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Yeah. So, and his power is Meteor Assault, which feels very significant to me. I like that a lot. We got an energy. These are all.
A fighting energy.
Yeah, fighting cards, except for the trainer Hop. What is Hop? Tell me about Hop while I do this.
So you played Pokemon Sword, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hop is like your friend rival, if you recall. He's the little brother of the current champion.
Yeah.
And he's like your little friend rival that you battle like after you get badges and stuff. He's there to like, you know, be like, I'm going to be the champion. Which one of us is going to be the champion first? And you're my rival and my friend.
Yeah. Okay.
He pushes you to be better.
Yeah, he's a supporter. That's what it says. Okay, so then the final card that I pulled is Passimian?
Passimian. Because he's like a rugby player monkey.
Okay. Righto. This might be too hard to figure out your career path with. This might be too much. Let's see. Yeah, okay. So I think that perhaps the question, like the career question, I feel like there's like a few things. One, I don't feel like there's like a specific thing that you're going to be the happiest in. I feel like it's more that you have been put into some really interesting positions that have given you the opportunity to really assess what you want out of your life. And so there's a lot of things that are kind of crashing together that are creating this moment of chaos that feels like you need to find something stable to put your energy into, or that you need to have like something that you're like holding on to that's going to make life easier to handle. And your career stuff and like kind of the question of career feels very contingent upon the kind of life that you want to live. And so those are questions that kind of need to be answered from you. And I don't think there is a specific, like, this is going to make you inherently happier than other things are going to make you. I don't think that that's going to be a thing that I would be able to tell you no matter what kind of reading we did. But I do feel like those are things that you're kind of coming into, that you're like kind of developing, that you're getting a little bit more, you're feeling more solid in those choices, or feeling like there's more ground for you to make those choices from.
Ground? Like a ground type
like
Pokemon?
Like a ground type. Well, so all of these, this is an entire fighting type deck. And I think what's really interesting is that we have Hop as a trainer, which is the supporter. And then the Passimian.
Yeah, it's like a grass fighting.
Has the call for family as one of his moves. And so that's really interesting to me that it's like call for family, supporter, and that you have an energy of like the fighting type energy, which is also like a support card to like make things better. And so it feels like there's an amalgamation of family that you're kind of pulling together that's going to help answer these questions. And I feel like family is a big thing that has been very... undefined or hard to define or hard to find, but is something that you have a lot of strength in and a lot of ability to rely on and a lot of ability to like believe and like trust and want to be. And so there's a little bit of this need from you to develop what family and home means and what that support system really looks like and really digging into that. And I really want to encourage you to look at other sources of family that are not perhaps what you always intended or what you always thought family would be, but now you've been given, you know what, I'm not going to expose your secrets on the podcast, but I will message you and I will tell you specifically what I'm talking about. Basically, family is going to be this family that you've kind of created by total fucking accident in a really beautiful way that you're like, how the fuck did we end up here? But that's going to be a strength that you need to pull on. That's something you need to look at. Something else is just really understanding the amount of power you personally hold and that you are totally capable of doing like fucking anything at all, but also that... you define what your own parameters are. So you define the amount of energy you have. You define the amount of support you have. You define the amount of strength that you exhibit in certain situations and behaviors. So it's really important for you to dig into that personal inner strength and really look at what that means. And I think that you'll find that the more you figure out family stuff, the more you talk about family stuff, the more you get closer to your family, the stronger that strength and that internal strength is going to become and the more accessible it will be for you to find when you need that strength. The other thing I want to say is that like you got the like the card, right?
The rare one.
The rare
the
card.
The holographic Galarian Surfetch.
Yes, like that's like feels so significant to me, right? And you have resistance. Like it just says like resistance on here, and I know that all of them have like a resistance specific, but like that was the biggest thing that brought me to it is like you have this ability to be something really incredible, to be someone really incredible that makes a really big difference, that does all of these things. But you're in the groundworking phase. Like you're figuring out who you are. You're building the bottom, the base of the things that you can do and the things that you want to do. And it's really important for you to give yourself fucking credit for that. And also, the most important part of anything is the foundation. You have to have a solid foundation. So focus now on building that foundation, on figuring out who you are and the things that you want, and let your family inform that, as well as being open to expanding what family means to you and where you get your source of support from.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think you got some dope cards. Like if that was your hand, like
yeah, you're sitting pretty good. Like there's plenty of cards that like draw three cards, draw two basic Pokemon. Like you have all of this, like...
And you have a fighting energy so that you can use the moves that Galarian Surfetched has.
Yeah, so it's like you're really well supported. It just is a matter of you figuring out how to direct that energy and how to use it strategically. Would you agree with that based on the hand?
And like the grounding and having a ground-type Pokemon. If not, one of the best ground-type Pokemon that's used competitively with Hippowdon.
Yeah.
So like, stay grounded, homie.
Yeah. Whoa, are you a psychic?
No.
That was very...
I like Pokemon.
That was a really... that was a good one. I think I'm wearing off on you. Yeah, that's the reading we have. Here we go.
Well, Ennin, I hope that reading was helpful for you. Hit us up on Patreon and Elle will do a reading for you on the show using whatever divination method we're covering. Patreon.com/Mancy. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends. The more support we have, the more episodes we can make. If you like my writing, you can pick up books at rjwalkerpoet.com.
If you wanted to get a reading from me, you can find me on Etsy at Laurels of Lux. I'm also on all of the platforms at Laurels of Lux. We have a whole bunch of social media that we just put out that's under at Mancy Pod, and our website is mancypodcast.com. So you guys can find us, join our Facebook group,
Mancy Podcast Memes for Stancy Podcast Teens.
And even if you're not a teen, come hang out, because we're definitely not fucking teens anymore.
Yeah. The music was provided by, in order of appearance, Hayden Folker, Arthi Vinka, Miyu, and Scott Buckley.